If you've bought property, you likely funded your purchase partly through a mortgage. If the property increases in value over time by more than the cost of the borrowing, you're better off. In the stock market, using debt is often called gearing. The new BetaShares Wealth Builder Funds, ASX ticker symbols G200 and GHHF, offer moderate gearing across Australian and global shares for investors who are comfortable with the higher risks associated with gearing their investments. You can discover how they work by visiting betashares.com.au. Please don't forget that gearing magnifies gains and losses, so read the relevant PDS and TMD on the website and consider if the fund is right for you. BetaShares Capital Limited is the issuer.
This is a podcast by the Rask Group. It's for educational purposes only. So please do not make a financial, legal, investment or taxation decision based on solely what you hear in this show.
Welcome to the Australian Property Podcast.
We're on a mission to be Australia's most trusted property podcast.
I'm Owen Rask, founder of the Rask Group.
I'm Pete Borgen, author and buyer's agent.
I'm Amy Linardi, and I am a buyer's agent.
I'm Chris Bates, ex-financial planner and mortgage broker.
Together, we'll take you through every step of your property journey.
From first home buyer to decades of property investing.
Amy Linardi, welcome to this episode of the podcast.
Hello, Owen.
Always a pleasure to see you. We were just chatting off air that I met with someone recently who used you as a buyer's agent in your team, and they were absolutely positively thrilled with the service. So that was a real delight, and I just thought I had to mention that to you. So kudos to you.
Always good to get those, you know, extra independent affirmations that I'm doing the right thing.
Yeah, it is. We love the feedback, right? People maybe don't think that they should give feedback to people when they use their services as a business or something, or even listen to this podcast, but we love the feedback. So I was so stoked. We're very lucky with what we do.
We are, and the podcast especially, because, you know, I'm sitting here in my office right now talking to you over the computer, and you just forget how many people are listening.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we do get the reviews and the feedback in person, we love it and we really appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah, it is great. So respect, kudos to you. Like I said, great job. So today we're talking about five emotional traps to avoid when buying a property. And no doubt, Amy, there are a lot more than five when it comes to buying a property. Because I, particularly with a first homeowner, I tend to think this is one of the most emotional things that people do.
Yeah.
And it's probably the most emotional thing people do with money. So there are a lot of things that we're going to talk about today, and we're going to try and narrow it down to these five, and hopefully people can discover something that helps them self-assess and also check themselves along the way.
Yeah, and this episode will be suitable for anyone who's either currently in the market or maybe you're, you know, many years away from buying. And it, whether you're a home buyer or a downsizer or an upsizer or a first home buyer or an investor, it's just important to understand how much psychology goes into buying a property, because it's just one of those things where you can't just go to the property store and say, I'll have that one. And that one's exactly suitable for me and I can afford it. And I'll take that today. Unlike a lot of other things in our life, you know, buying a car or buying a new TV, et cetera. And I think that emotions are very allowable. And in fact, I encourage emotions when buying a home. And if you're not emotional in any kind of way, then I would say, well, you know, why not? Maybe allow that to come in a little bit, because it needs to play into it. And, you know, I'm sure there's a proportion of people out there who don't care as much about their accommodation. They just say it's a roof over my head. But for a lot of people, that's their sanctuary. That's the place, you know, they're raising their family, they're coming home to, they want to feel safe and secure in. And therefore that, you know, it's a big part of their lives, and therefore emotions absolutely do play into it.
Mm-hmm. I like that you said that, like, it's allowable. There was the late, great Daniel Kahneman, who wrote the book Thinking Fast and Slow, for folks that know it.
He talked about behavioral biases in his entire career, basically. And he was the pioneer of something called loss aversion bias, which is our tendency to avoid things that might result in loss. And he basically said in interviews across decades, he basically said it's impossible to avoid these biases of our, you know, of our behavior. The best we can probably do is just acknowledge that they exist and just try to be aware of them. So I'm glad you said that. But when it does come to property, I think it is a huge tendency for people to get emotional. So I guess, is there a limit to how much is allowable? Like, how do you think about this? Let's start stepping through these five things.
Yeah. So the first one is the one that I think that people think about the most when they think about emotions and property, and that is getting too emotionally invested.
Yeah.
And then through being too emotionally invested in, say, a particular property, for example, that you've inspected and you want to pursue, that you get carried away, or you let your emotions cloud your decision making, or you pay too much for the property. And that is, I think that's one of I see a lot of buyer's agents having in their sales pitch, we won't let you overpay for properties, et cetera. And I think the word overpaying is poorly used sometimes, because sometimes people will pay what a property is worth for them, and what I would pay for something might be very different to what you would pay, Owen, depending on how long you've been looking, how suitable it is. There's so many different factors there. So the short of it is to say that you do need to have some emotion when you're buying a home, because again, you're going to live in it and hopefully for a very long time. So the first thing you have to do before you even start going out and looking at properties is to really spend so much time on your research and putting your brief together to have that, you know, baseline to keep coming back to and saying, okay, well, does this property tick all of my boxes? I've got a really great case study from a couple of years ago where these clients had said to me, you know, we have a non-negotiable of, you know, having single level property, and we have to have the kitchen so it looks into the yard so we can see the kids playing, spend a lot of time cooking, et cetera.
Is it?
And we discounted quite a few properties on the basis they didn't suit. And then they came across this property which backed onto, you know, the Merri Creek here, out in Ivanhoe. It was three levels. The kitchen was nowhere near the yard. And because the yard backed onto the creek, there was a risk of snakes.
Yeah.
She just fell in love with it. And I had to bring her back to that original brief and said, this is so different to what you originally wanted. But she just had this emotional connection to it, the way it was presented and styled. And anyway, by having that brief to always come back to, that's one way to avoid emotions detracting you too much from that.
Mm. Actually, let's just quickly, I actually love that idea of that non-negotiable. I actually really like that. Thinking as someone who might start a family and do these types of things, I've never come across that as a non-negotiable. So I think that's actually really cool. I really like that.
Yeah. Your non-negotiables need to still be realistic, because if you've got too many of them, you're going to have no options or very few options.
Yeah.
But if that's something that's really important to you and that you value and that you can clearly see that is achievable, absolutely have it in.
Yeah.
But you might have to make compromises in other spaces.
For sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
And I think one of those, another thing that comes up all the time when telling people to avoid being too emotional about a property, and I always hear this saying to say, don't let the agent see how much you like the property. Don't let the agent see how desperate you are to get that property. Downplay your interest.
Yeah.
And, you know, to a certain extent, that's correct. But at the end of the day, you could love that property more than anything else and be desperate to get it, but you've only got a certain budget. And the agents know that buyers just can't pay anything just because they love a property.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you need to see a property three times, or you've accidentally told the agent you really like the property, don't stress about that. Don't worry about that. Because again, at the end of the day, you'll only have a certain amount to pay for it. And yes, you might need to be a bit more savvy with your negotiations later, but don't downplay your interest too much, because that can have a That can have actually a negative impact if the agent doesn't think you're interested at all. You've downplayed it to the point where they don't even call you if they get an offer, or you're being really negative and critical about that and they're passing that along to the vendor. And if the vendor gets to the point where they don't want to deal with you because they think that you hate their house, that has happened before. I have seen that happen before. Obviously, yeah. Not with me. I don't let that happen. But you've got to be really careful. Careful here. Better to look too invested than not invested enough in a property.
But obviously the fear of people is that they let on too much and they're kind of taken advantage of, so to speak, by the agent and who can kind of, I guess, kind of manipulate them into doing something. I'm curious then, so you would basically say, yeah, be emotional, but just know that you've got this fixed line of like a budget and this is the ceiling?
Well, and at the end of the day, I've had plenty of negotiations where I've said to the real estate agent, look, my clients really love the property, but this is all they can pay, or this is all they're prepared to pay, or this is all they can pay because they have to do certain works, et cetera. And sometimes that's a more helpful negotiation strategy than arguing with an agent about value.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, you just need to, I guess, if you're going down that route where you have expressed like a lot of interest and showing that you're really keen, you know, use that to your advantage and say, I do really want this property and I wish I could go more. I wish I could go higher. Mm-hmm. You might still have an extra 50 grand to play with in your budget, but that's your tactic with the negotiations.
Yeah.
So you can come back from that. Yeah.
Yeah. I like it. How about then if someone is an investor as opposed to like a home buyer? Home buyers obviously thinking about it not just for financial reasons, but also for lifestyle reasons. But an investor, I was chatting to a guy the other day actually, and he just bought a property and he seemed so completely non-emotional about it. It was clear that it was just a transaction to him. So does emotion come in there?
A little bit. And I never say don't be completely emotionless about an investment property, because ideally it's still, when you come across a property that you think is going to be a great investment for you, you know, you should be like, yeah, this is really good. I can see myself holding this for a really long time. It'd be a great addition to my portfolio. You know, I can see why there's going to be capital growth and why investors will like it. I like it. You know, and it needs to come into play a little bit. You want to have a little bit of disappointment if you miss out on it, but certainly nowhere near as much as buying a home. And all of this comes into play when you are trying to figure out what your competitive buffer is for pursuing a property. So when I'm helping clients figure out how much to spend on a property, first of all, I'm doing a comparable sales analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Using tangible evidence of sold recent properties to say, okay, well, this is how much it should be worth at the moment, overlaying, you know, current market conditions, market growth, scarcity, all of those things to say, okay, well, this is the benchmark for value. And then on top of that, ideally you have some kind of competitive buffer which factors in competition. Yeah. Because if you're just going for properties as to exactly what they're, you know, you think they're worth on market value, you're just relying on a little bit of hope that there's no one else that would pay a little bit more, et cetera. So having that competitive buffer is necessary and you don't have to use it, but it's there if you need to. For example, going to auction and you say, well, I might spend $1 million on this property. I would spend it if I really had to, but the goal is to get it for less because I think it's worth maybe $950,000-ish, but I would spend $1 million if I had to. And the emotions come into play here because the more you like a property, the more you love a property, the more boxes it ticks, the longer you've been searching for, the more scarce this property is. All of these factors play into that buffer and then determine if you are just going to stretch a little bit for it or, you know, like as a very rough ballpark, you might say, okay, I'm willing to go up to 5% above market value for this if I have to. Yeah, whereas as an investor, you might only go a couple of percent.
Yeah.
I've had clients who would say, I'm more than happy to, if I absolutely had to, under competition, go up to 10% more.
Yeah.
This client recently, they've been looking in this one particular street for 2 years, 3 years actually.
Wow.
So they had their competitive buffer. We didn't have to use it, but it was there if we needed to. So that's where emotion comes in to help figure out that buffer. Because otherwise, if you're going for properties all the time that you love, but you're not taking a buffer along in the negotiations or whatever, you might miss out. You might get lucky, but you're not putting yourself in a position where you're where you've got it like the best chance of securing that home.
It's interesting that they would be looking for 3 years as well for a particular street, but that, you know, good quality assets don't change hands as often as the bad quality assets, right? So
yeah. Well, this street overlooks the river as well. So
beautiful. Yep.
And they weren't in a rush, you know, that was their choice. But, you know, most people have a broader location parameter than just one street.
I feel like I don't think it's in our list for today, but I feel like one of the things where people kind of set themselves up or position themselves to get more emotional is when they do add those artificial constraints of like, I need to buy a house in the next 3 months because there's really no reason.
Or you're having a baby, or you need to get into a school zone, or you're changing jobs and you want to maximize your current borrowing capacity. There is actually a lot of reasons why people have time urgency sometimes.
Yeah.
Legit reasons. Yeah. And that's, I guess it's an emotional, but more of like a stress emotion, not a desire emotion.
Yeah.
It's different.
No,
yeah.
Not at all. Yeah. The next one is the need for social proof. And we see this a lot, like the Great Australian Dream, White Picket Fence, Golden Retriever, so on and so forth, so to speak. This can run rampant with particularly first home buyers, but even people I see with upgraders, social proof from their peers or their friends, like keeping up with the Joneses, social proof from things they see online, or a big one is family.
Yeah, exactly right. But when I see social proof being the biggest issue with property is where some people need someone else to want that particular property for them to want that property or for them to pay a certain price.
Right, right.
Yeah. Okay. So for example, and this is especially where you haven't done a lot of research up front, you're doubting yourself around the value of that property, which for some properties can be really challenging. So say you're looking at a private sale property or it's off market. So maybe it's only you that's looked at it or a few other people, and you haven't done that research beforehand about, okay, how much do I think it's worth and how much am I prepared to pay? Then when it comes down to the negotiations, I do see people having self-doubt to say, okay, well, what if I'm paying too much? You know, there's no one else that's put a bid in on this property or put an offer on this property. What's wrong with it?
Oh, yeah.
You know, and this is where you have to rely on your own due diligence to be able to help you make those decisions. And I've seen it many times before where an agent will, you know, try and sell a property off market or pre-market, and they'll take a few buyers through and the buyers will be umming and ahhing. And then all of a sudden it goes on the internet and then it goes to auction and those buyers are prepared to pay more.
Yeah.
Because their decisions or their price has been validated by someone else.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I see this happen quite a lot too with a pass in at an auction where maybe that property, you know, there's so many reasons why a property could pass in. A pass in means that the bidding hasn't reached the reserve at an auction. And I've been to many auctions over the years because I was thinking the other day, I've done over a thousand auctions.
Yeah.
Easily. And, you know, sometimes it's just a bit of bad luck for that vendor where certain buyers don't rock up on the day, or maybe they've bought something else the previous week or whatever's happened. And I'm the only person there. It's just great. It's a great opportunity. But then the buyer says, well, no one else is bidding. What's wrong with the property? Am I going to be paying too much? And I have to remind them, well, this is an opportunity to now get a property for less than what we were prepared to pay, you know, often under our competitive buffer. This is an opportunity.
Yeah.
But it's very common for people to feel uncomfortable if they haven't had bidding.
Yeah.
Doubt themselves.
This social proof thing is something that's always been fascinating to me. And for anyone that's read the book Persuasion by Robert Cialdini, Professor Robert Cialdini, it's a fantastic insight into this. And he uses some examples of, I'm going to be quite glib here, stories of, say, people that might be attacked or something happens outside their apartment building, and everyone rushes to the window to see, why is this person screaming or yelling? Right? What's the commotion? And the first person goes to the window and sees what's happening, like, oh, maybe something's happened, but they don't move. They kind of go into shock. Like, I don't know what's happening out there. But then the next person on a different building comes to the window and sees that first person who's not doing anything, and they think, oh, it must not be anything to worry about. And then the next person, and then it creates this social proof where they should all probably do something, and this social proof phenomenon plays out. And it's so powerful. You don't realize, particularly when you're in this emotional state.
Oh, absolutely. I can see that happening in so many different situations. And with property, it's just a case of, again, the with anything, right? The more research you do at the start, the less self-doubt, hopefully, you will have later on. And if you feel like you can't make decisions by yourself without someone else helping, like that's where I often come in and help clients to say, well, no, this is, I think you're doing the right thing. I think this is the right value for all of these reasons. We do so much homework together to help them come to that decision, whether that's, you know, the price or whether we go for that property. And that's all sometimes people need. I've worked with plenty of clients who know they can, like, I know they can do it themselves. They just need that extra, you know, voice of reason. And so, yeah, if you're in a situation where you don't have competition, think of it as a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm just like, I think it's just having that conviction in yourself while not also being too overconfident per the first point.
That's right.
And getting help, expert help is a huge way to do that. Number three is allowing real estate agents slash negotiations to impact your decision-making. This is interesting because I see a very effective, as someone who likes to get on the tools and, you know, be quite handy around the house, Amy, I find that this strategy, which I'm about to say, works really well for me. So I'm giving away my weak spot to all of the agents that are listening, but I find a really effective strategy that seems to get me over the line and get me emotionally excited about something is when they're
saying things like, oh, you could knock down this wall and, you know, open plan living, and then you could put, like, you know, some downlights here and do that. Look how great that is. You could put a window there. And I'm just thinking, yeah, he or she, yeah, completely right. And I'm just like wound up in this thing. I'm like, yeah, I could do that. And
then they're selling you a vision.
They're not selling the current house. They're selling what all the work you've got to do and you don't realize. So how do agents impact our decision making?
So something that I see now and again is where a buyer will have a really negative interaction with a real estate agent or agency, and it'll just totally cloud their judgment moving forward with that property transaction, or, you know, seeing other properties that agent has sold. Perhaps they've been, you know, in their words, burnt by an agent in a negotiation. It didn't play out the way that they wanted it to. Although sometimes when I ask them further questions, I say to them, it's not actually the agent's fault. You just didn't ask the right questions. But this is really, it's really common where we have this saying, like, don't let a bad agent or a bad vendor get in the way of you buying a property if you really want it, because some agents can just be really poor with communication. They can be really rude. They can, you know, be outright lying to you, and you catch them up in a lie and then you don't trust them. And vendors too can be really challenging to deal with via the agent. So, you know, you kind of have to sometimes take a bit of a deep breath and just be the bigger person in these situations, because a couple of times I have seen people get just that bit too emotional and say, I'm not going to bother anymore. This has just become too hard. And I said, don't let, again, a bad agent come between you and a good property.
Yes.
And this is also the case of if a negotiation is not playing out the way that you want it to. You know, there's so many myths around negotiating to say, well, a common one I find is that, you know, a buyer will say, well, I've come up 20 grand. The vendor should come down 20 grand off their price. It just doesn't work that way. The negotiation has 100 different ways it can play out. But I have seen many instances where, you know, a buyer says, well, you know, the vendor's not playing ball, or the agent's playing games, or whatever it is. And it's not necessarily the case. Like, maybe the vendor just, they won't sell for any less, and that's it. And you've been coming up on price, but you started at a really low price. There's so many variables there.
Yeah.
I had a client a while ago who got himself so worked up about this whole thing. Vendors being so stubborn, the vendor's not playing ball. And I've said, well, we've actually been given opportunity to buy this property pre-market. The vendor wasn't sure if they wanted to sell pre-market. They're giving us an opportunity to do so, but this is the price that they're willing to do it. Otherwise, they're just going to go to auction.
Yeah,
and you're saying that they're not being negotiable, but that they don't have to be.
Yeah, so, they've taken a big step in just doing that, to be honest. Yeah.
Exactly, and that was, you know, I had to coach him through that because it just for some reason really impacted him and his own decision making. But yeah, I do see this quite often. I have to be, well, as a buyer's agent, we have to be very Switzerland. I've got a few agents in my who are off my Christmas card list, let's just say that, but I have to deal with them still and I have to put on a smiley face.
Yeah. I think in this instance, it also comes down to knowing who they are and what role they play. I think you know this better than anyone, but just if you're new to the buying experience, or if you know you're prone to this, just be aware of their incentive and who they represent, and you know where they sit in that relationship. I think that's kind of the first step to just knowing that any of the information that may come is an opportunity to hear the words and to hear what they're saying, but also just remember it's your property, you're the one buying it. And
that's a really great point, yeah. Because I guess the flip side can happen too, where an agent is being too helpful and too friendly, and sometimes buyers get really suspicious of that.
Yeah.
And say, what's this guy's agenda? Well, maybe he's just a nice guy that wants to help you buy this property.
Yeah.
Still working for the vendor. But you've got to then not fall into the trap of listening to everything that they say, because some things might not intentionally be lies, but maybe they're giving you the wrong information because they've been given the wrong information. So if you're overly trusting because they have been super helpful, that can be a problem too.
Yeah, absolutely. I know some great real estate agents in my area, just lovely people. And like you said, sometimes it just is what it is, and they may not have all the pieces of the puzzle too. So another thing that we see a lot in people that buy properties is the tendency to wait until there's that kind of laundry list of items and every single one of them are ticked. Is that emotional or is that just logical?
So there's two ways to think of that. When you've got your property brief and your non-negotiables, you have to tick all of those boxes. That's the whole point of having non-negotiables. If it doesn't tick one of them, don't even look at it.
Yeah.
Or maybe you might see a property and it doesn't tick all of them. It makes you reassess your non-negotiables, which is totally fine, of course.
Listen.
And then you've got all of your bonuses as well, which is like, you know, the property will score higher if, you know, it ticks these boxes. But what I often see is people waiting for the one, walking into that property and just thinking, wow, this is my house. This is that feeling that they're trying to find. And I liken it to going like online dating and walking into like dates and just, you know, feeling like you need to have that feeling straight away with someone. It doesn't always happen that way. I think I went on like 4 or 5 dates with my husband before I was like, yeah, you're all right.
hopefully he's not listening.
He knows. So yeah, he was the same. And that feeling that people are trying to create, sometimes you can get it. And that's awesome. I've had so many clients who are like, I know this is the property. It's just the one. I've got this great feeling for it. And we get it or we don't get it. But then if we don't get it, challenging thing is trying to recreate that feeling, which you might not be able to.
Yeah.
And the problem is there that you might then just continuously discount properties that tick all of your non-negotiables because you're striving for this feeling that may or may not exist. And that can be a real problem. And that's where I see people looking for a really long time. And I do homework with them and I say, what about this one that sold? Why didn't you go for that? It ticks all the boxes. It sold within budget. I just didn't get the right feel from it. I just didn't like it.
Mm.
So one of my tips here is to first of all acknowledge that this feeling might not be achievable. Secondly, to acknowledge that this is not necessarily going to be your forever home.
Yeah.
For many people, especially first home buyers, it won't be. And then another way to think about it is, what do you think will give you that feeling? Or if you've had that feeling before, what do you think it was from? And in some situations, especially with first home buyers, it's because that property has been beautifully presented or styled or, you know, trendy, creative work lives there. And I've seen 2 apartments literally exactly the same before. One of them was a rental, was just a bit battered around. And the other one exactly the same, but just had this like lovely homely feeling and, you know, sheer linen curtains and it'd been really well cared for. And there was no one interested in the other one. And then the nicely presented one sold for heaps more than it should have because it was that feeling. I said, well, just you can recreate that feeling in many instances. So try and figure out what you like about it. Or another feeling that people often get is not realizing natural light. They'll walk into a property and it's not the right orientation. They'll say, I just couldn't place my finger on why I didn't like it. And I'll look at it and I'll say, I think it's maybe because it was all south-facing windows, so it was dark. I'll say, yeah, that's probably it. So then it's like, okay, well, don't go and look at south-facing properties. So
that makes sense. Yeah, it's interesting that people would reflect on that. And I was just thinking about some places that I've inspected and like the ones that stood out to me and why they were so nice. And it's some of those things that you've mentioned, but also probably some things that I didn't necessarily think about until just now. So we've got four so far. So we've got avoiding being too emotional, and that often leads to overpaying. Obviously, some emotions are fine. The need for social proof, and you mentioned people have that self-doubt, which is a really interesting form of it. And then you've got the agents impacting the way you perceive a property, or the negotiations not going the way that you had hoped. Number four was waiting for the one. Mentioned the dating analogy, which is quite interesting, or the feeling that someone gets from walking to properties. Like kind of when I walk into Costco, I get that feeling, and I just know I'm going to spend a lot of money. But that brings us to lucky number five. What's fifth on the list?
So the fifth one is really just having this constant underlying feeling of self-doubt, or not having confidence in your own decision-making, which the longer you are looking for a property, the worse this feeling is going to become, because you're like, what am I not doing right? Or I just don't feel comfortable making a decision. So that self-doubt is a super emotional, you know, thing that impacts you. And if you have a partner, this can be further compounded, because you both might be playing into each other's insecurities here, and you both can't make decisions. Or if you're totally on the wrong page to begin with, you've got to sort that out, because you might then fall in love with the property. Your partner says, nah, don't like it at all. And that causes emotional stress in your own relationship. And you just get exhausted as time goes by. And for some people, they do get to the point where they just say, oh, I'm just going to buy whatever. But a lot of other people, sometimes they'll just turn and take a break for a long time. It's again, dating. The more you go online dating, the more exhausted you get. You say, I've got to take a break from all this, reset. So for our clients, on average, we take around 6 to 8 weeks to buy a property. But for most people, that's not realistic. But if it's taken you, if you've been looking for longer than 6 months, and I say actively looking, like properly looking out there every weekend and making offers, et cetera, or seriously considering properties, longer than 6 months is where you start to think, I've got to reassess here, or I've got to get a bit of professional help. But the main, apart from personality traits, because some people can just be naturally anxious, of course, and have insecurity, et cetera, the main way to fix all of this and to be prepared for it is, I'm going to say it again, doing that research beforehand, knowing what you can afford, knowing what's selling in those areas, your alternative options, and having a clear and defined property brief, being on the same page as your partner, doing all of that before you officially start searching for a property. That is the best way to be able to avoid this procrastination, self-doubt, and changing your mind at the last minute, and all of these things, which are just common buyer pitfalls that I see. And it all stems through that, through emotions.
It's interesting. Again, that self-doubt comes up. I was going to ask you earlier on how long it would typically take you to work through these things, because, you know, on the financial advice side of town, I see that a financial advisor's role increasingly, as like technology and things take over a lot of the day-to-day financial questions that people have, I see a human's role in that, like the financial expert's role in that, to be so much more behavioral and more focused in that way. But oftentimes when you ask the question, well, how long would it take you to buy a property? Like, it depends. Yeah. But I'm glad you answered that, because a lot of people would be getting months into that journey, getting frustrated, maybe even being turned off, maybe prices are going up, all of these different things. And it just becomes even more emotional, to the point of like, they're either paralyzed, or they feel defeated. And so I'd imagine when you say, this is just like an aside, Amy, but I imagine when you say 6 to 8 weeks, I imagine you're getting a lot of people who have been through that journey, and therefore they feel like they've already tried a lot of those strategies.
Yeah, sometimes yes, and sometimes they'll be starting fresh, but regardless of what stage they're at in their journey, we do all the homework together before I say yes to helping them, and before I charge them anything, to make sure I can help them.
Yeah.
And, you know, analysis paralysis, like you said, that's another thing as well, where you can be over-researched and do too much research to the point where you question yourself, or you're focusing on the wrong things too. That is common. And, you know, with property, you know, I don't have these issues because I work in the industry and I'm a professional. But, you know, when I've been renovating in the past, I encountered this so much with my emotions. Like, I know what I'm trying to achieve and I know what I like, but I would stay up, you know, for hours, not, not for hours, but I would just do my head in trying to choose the right doorknob for my cabinets. Yep. That's just so ridiculous, isn't it? But I just was like, I didn't have the self-doubt. And I just ended up getting an interior designer for the last project because I knew I couldn't make decisions. So sometimes you might get to the point where you do need to just say, acknowledge your flaws and all your things where you're lacking and just get a little bit of help, whether that's through a buyer's agent or, it's basically through a buyer's agent.
Yeah, yeah. But I see it all the time too, not just in like say property, like mortgage brokers, accountants. You talk about having like kind of like an all-star team around you. I think maybe this is just a thing as you get older, you start to realize where you should invest some of your time and invest some of your emotions and invest some of your energy. And as I've got older, I used to have this real DIY mentality, and now I'm kind of not polar opposite, but I still want to be involved. I still want to have direction and be thoughtful and I guess intentional about how I do things. But more and more, I'm getting around this idea of having kind of like an executive team, so to speak, like a team that works for me that I can trust that they're really good at their job, and I'm obviously going to pay them because that's what they're going to do because they're really good at their job. But things like a really good accountant, a really good mortgage broker, maybe you don't have to pay the lawyer every month, and hopefully not, but like if you're in business, you probably do have a lawyer that you want to refer back to for really tricky situations. And the more time has gone on, the more I see the benefit in that bigger picture, not just from longer term financial outcomes. That's one thing. But the big thing is like the emotional weight of all of those other things that I would have to think about in order to get up to speed and be even close to someone like that. I think it makes so much sense. So.
Well, that's exactly right. And it is hard though, because when you're starting out, especially, you can't necessarily afford all these things. And my first renovation I did on such a budget. I couldn't afford anything. I couldn't afford a professional help. But then the most recent one, I could afford it, and I saw the value in it.
Yeah.
But with buying a property, because at whatever price point you're at, even if you're a first home buyer and it's your first property and you're spending a lot in comparison to the median of that city, it's almost more important to have that help to avoid making the wrong choice. But, totally aware that a buyer's agent is not within the budget or capacity of a lot of people. But certainly having a good, amazing team, including a mortgage broker, doesn't cost you any extra to have the best mortgage broker.
Yeah. So. No, it doesn't. You're right. You're spot on because of the way that, they're remunerated and it's all kind of the same these days. So it's actually a really good point. And, Pete often talks about on the show how we all kind of do, but Pete in particular is always saying how it's like a springboard, that first property and where it takes you and these types of things. And thinking about getting that springboard right, you want to be bouncing off in the right direction. Mm. So emotions are definitely one of the things that I see clouding most people's judgment. And it's, as Amy said in this episode, it is totally reasonable that if you're buying a house right now, that's perfectly reasonable. I was emotional, and I would bet that Amy had some emotions in the day that she was buying her first home or even another home. So that's okay. But these five ways are ways that you can trip up. So be mindful of them and try to manage them as best you can. I love these conversations about behavioral biases or like emotional intersections with finance and our long-term wealth goals. So, I mean, this has been heaps of fun. You do have a checklist that is available in the show notes of every episode of the podcast. So if you are buying a property, there's one of Amy's checklists down there. You just can click that. It's free. And it may be enough to help guide you and to help you ask the right questions, check for the right things as you go on this emotional journey. So Amy, heaps of fun as always. It's a pleasure.
Thanks, Owen. See you next time.
Thanks for tuning into the Australian Property Podcast.
If you love the show, why not subscribe or leave us a review on Apple or Spotify?
And if you want to work with me, Amy, Pete, or Chris,
you'll find links in your podcast player to get in contact with us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Australian Property Podcast. We're huge advocates of getting the right advice at the right time from the right people. That's why it's important to understand that this podcast episode contained general financial information only. It is not designed to be specific or personalized to your financial, tax, or legal situation. With property, the check sizes are pretty big, so it's important you get advice from a licensed and trusted professional before acting on the information you hear in RASC podcasts. Thanks again for listening.
For more than a decade, I've been hunting for the best investors and their methods, strategies, and tools for investing. After years in the industry, countless books, a few degrees, and 1,000 podcasts and live shows, I've rolled this accumulated knowledge into something called RASC Invest. If you've ever heard me talk about a core and a satellite, active and passive, true long-term compounding, or you simply want to know exactly how I would invest, now is your chance. RASC Invest is our new investment service, designed for all types of investors who want professional management of their core portfolio at a low cost from a team they trust. RASC Invest helps you automate your wealth creation and passive income. Simply click the link that says Invest with Owen in your podcast player to join one of our live platform walkthroughs or book a call with us. You can also view the RASC Invest PDS and TMD and get invested with me.